You're listening to CKMS News on CKMS 102.7 FM in Waterloo, Ontario, radiowaterloo.ca on the web. This program is part of the Local Journalism Initiative Grant Program and is funded by the Community Radio Fund of Canada, the Government of Canada, and the CKMS Newsroom. You can access the recordings of this show on radiowaterloo.ca/news or on the National Local Journalism Initiative website. I'm your host, Trish Holmes, and if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, my username is at mrdarnley. You may remember back in April, CKMS reported on the initial meeting to build a tent city at Lot 42. At that meeting, 3 months ago now, the homeless community was faced with an ultimatum. Find shelter and risk contracting COVID, or sleep rough and risk the any number of other ways to impact health that sleeping rough brings. Lot 42 offered an alternative where people who are homeless can physical distance, quarantine, and obtain access to climate-controlled buildings, amenities, and a good night's sleep. 3 months on, Lot 42 is now a better tent city and has been heralded as a creative and humane approach to a public health crisis and to homelessness in general. A better tent city is assured the use of property until spring 2021. In early July, the City of Kitchener waived the zoning requirements, effectively sanctioning the site. At the site currently are 12 8x10 cabins and 18 tents inside a Lot 42 building. In all, about 40 residents work together to keep the site operational. The community-oriented nature of the site's operation reflects the community-oriented nature of the way in which the project came together. The site is operated entirely on donations from businesses and individuals. I recently talked to Jeff Wilmer to get an update on the site. Jeff is one of the people who have been instrumental in bringing a better tent city to life. He is the former chief administrative officer for the City of Kitchener, and here he confirms the numbers on site at a better tent city and describes the environment.
So we're around 30 or 40 people, but roughly half tenting indoors and half living in cabins.
It's a community work model. How is that going?
That's going pretty well. Like they're keeping the place orderly, definitely keeping it clean. They've got their own kitchen facility, so they're washing the dishes and cleaning the counters and that type of thing. It's not quite as tidy and orderly as it was in the early days. People are starting to accumulate stuff, and so that's understandable, but it is a bit of a concern for us that it's starting to accumulate more as the weeks go by.
But it seems like it's an incredible success. The city's on board, like the papers are all glowing about it.
Yeah, the community response, the media response has been terrific. And the community itself, the 30 or 40 people, have really stepped up. They're managing this themselves without any supervision, without any staff. There's no salaried people there.
Right.
And they're managing their own community. So that's been really heartwarming to see. While we're pleased with the success of this, we don't really consider it to be successful until somebody replicates it. The idea here was to pilot this, to show that it can work, in hopes that it could be replicated elsewhere in the community or anywhere across Canada. And so while it's successful to a degree, we haven't seen it been copied yet. So we're still working for that level of success.
You've had a lot of municipalities contact the city or contact you or...
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. We've had quite a number of contacts from across Canada. And none of those has yet resulted in a community of cabins. And I think the biggest challenge is finding the right property owner, whether it's the municipality or a private or a not-for-profit. We're now realizing how rare it is to have somebody like Ron who's willing to take the risk.
A better tent city is meant to be a pilot, and the idea is to get somebody to replicate it in the community or across Canada. So how does one go about replicating a project like this? First, you need the right people. Alongside Jeff, the site materialized thanks to Ron Doyle and Nadine Green. Ron Doyle is a local entrepreneur and the owner of the Hacienda Sara and Lot 42. Doyle contributed the land and facilities and is currently covering the majority of the expenses, such as utilities, on the site.
So I give all the credit to Ron Doyle. You know, he made his property and his building that made it work. At this point, haven't found another property owner, including the municipalities, that are willing to host a sanctioned tent city or a supported community.
In addition to Jeff and Ron, Nadine Green has been a fundamental force in building a better tent city. Nadine is the former convenience store owner who was evicted from her downtown Kitchener store premises this past January. It's no coincidence that Green also permitted people without shelter a refuge from the elements at her store. Green is credited with being the heart and soul of the site.
So Nadine Green is really the key to the success of the community, because Ron and I aren't there on a daily basis.
And she is.
And she is there around the clock. And she's literally the glue that holds it together, and the style that she brings to it is more of a, she's a mother figure really for the community, right? It's encouraging people to do the right thing, not forcing them to. And that group is responding well to her.
The very existence of a better tent city is down to the people. But who pays for things, and what are the costs? What are the monthly costs to have as many people as are on site at Lot 42?
Yeah. Okay, so let's start with the capital cost. The capital, the fundraising is generally easier for capital, right? People are willing to give money to buy or build something that they can see. And so for less than $3,000 per cabin, we've been able to acquire the cabins, insulate them, finish them, put a bed in, all of that for less than $3,000. So you're actually buying somebody a home for under $3,000, which is an individual or small group of people can chip together and do that, which is pretty exciting, really. Mm-hmm. And so the capital fundraising was the easy part. We were able to raise $50,000 in community fundraising in just a little over a month without any kind of resources put to it. That was just word of mouth and good media coverage. So that was, for us, that was the easiest part.
Was that this year in April?
From the middle of April through till probably about the end of May. It's still ongoing, but the majority of it happened in that first month and a half.
Okay.
And so then the operating costs, depending on your facility, can be pretty minimal. If there are no facilities at all, you would at least need porta potties. So the cost of renting and dumping the porta potties as needed. If you've got a building, then your toilets are covered and your washrooms are covered, maybe kitchen and shower facilities as well, possibly. So then the main operating cost is the cost of utilities.
Right.
So that's fairly modest. We've been able to do it with no staff, no supervision. It's a self-managed community, and I think that is the model that most people would be aiming for, because you really can't justify having, you know, security around the clock or support services. Support services are very helpful and very useful. It's just that it's a cost that we haven't been able to justify yet.
Okay.
So it's really the cost of utilities. So it's going to depend on the nature of your facilities and the number of people who are living there.
Community donations have been important to the success of the project, as was finding the right location and the right host.
The biggest challenge around this is trying to find host properties. And again, if the city and the region, and I know they're looking, but if they're able to come up with one, then everybody else might sit back and think, okay, well, you know, that's the job of government, so good on you. I don't have to do anything. But if they can't or won't, then it really does come back to the private sector, the not-for-profits, the faith communities. That's where, if you're willing, I think your story could lead, is to challenge the owners of private property that's being underutilized right now, or buildings that are being underutilized, or the not-for-profit sector, and certainly faith communities. I mean, faith communities have land, they have buildings, they have human resources and people who care. I think there's a big opportunity there if they can just get past those hurdles about the logistics and the risks and those type of things.
The day I met Jeff Wilmer to get an update on A Better Tent City, he also showed me around a new initiative of St. Mary's Church in downtown Kitchener. The church has purchased cabins for use at A Better Tent City or a second site should one become available. The cabins, or micro shelters, have a door and two windows and come with a bed frame. Each cabin is 8x10 in size and painted in vivid blue, purple, peach, and green. The cabins are currently outside St. Mary's Steps, where volunteers have been preparing them for use. Jeff showed me the cabins and answered my questions.
Will they be wired as well?
These ones are going to be, in two ways. A community member donated rooftop solar collector panels and batteries and wiring. And so we need to figure out how to get the wiring from outside to inside and then finish the insulation. But that's pretty small scale. Like, that gives you a light and a way to charge your bike. The other thing, though, is proper wiring and a radiator type heater mounted to the wall so that you have a proper heat source in the winter. And so Father Toby's project will have that from the beginning. Ours, we may or may not do it.
So these are all built to withstand the winter?
They are, well, yeah. An insulated cabin, which is only 80 square feet, with a person's own body heat will generally keep that pretty warm on all but the very coldest of nights.
Projects like this, alongside A Better Tent City, illustrate how communities can come together to help people. There are about 250 homeless people in Kitchener, and this project has already helped close to 40. Providing help for 20% of any population is hugely beneficial, but still the need for homes, stability, and help is great. Jeff described the reality for people who are currently homeless in Kitchener.
Being encampments around town quite a bit.
The one at Victoria and Weaver.
One at Victoria and Weaver. Yeah. There's another one over behind the School of Pharmacy. And elsewhere in the region, there's quite a number of encampments. And so clearly there are people who are still homeless and unsheltered. And so there's a need to do something more.
Despite initiatives like A Better Tent City, there are still big challenges to be met. The COVID crisis has forced an opportunity upon us to find new solutions to old problems.
So how's the Friendship had the Charles Street Hostel, right, where they've got, I think, 60 beds at the men's hostel or a men's shelter? And they typically have 5 or 6 people sharing a room. It's bunks or dorms. Mm-hmm. And so clearly with COVID, they had to do something differently. And so the Radisson Hotel was virtually empty. And the House of Friendship, and I think the region supported it, basically reserved a huge block of rooms at the Radisson. Mm-hmm. And they moved the Charles Street Men's Shelter to the Radisson Hotel. So now instead of having 5 or 6 people bunking to a room, now people are 1 or 2 to a room. So that was better from a COVID perspective. But the really interesting part of this is that in a very short period of time, like just a month or two, people were able to get the residents were able to get a good night's sleep. There were health care support, so nurses, mental health workers, addictions counselors, and within just a month or two, people were able to get their lives straightened around and get back on track and transform their lives and be willing to seriously try to beat their addiction. Just because they were able to get a good night's sleep and not have to be up and out by 9 o'clock in the morning with the old hostel rules and those type of things. So the House of Friendship was saying, we can never go back to the old model. With the old model, we were just basically giving people a warm, dry place to sleep. But we weren't really changing their lives. Right. Now we're able to change their lives and transform and give them hope and set them on a better path. So, interestingly, we've kind of done the same thing, right? That with the cabin, people have, they can get a good night's sleep, they peace of mind. They don't have to sleep with one eye open because somebody's going to steal their stuff. They can lock up their things and be out and about in the daytime and not worry that all their worldly belongings will be stolen. So they have that peace of mind and they're stable and not isolated because they're living in community, so much less likely to overindulge in their drug of choice or whatever that is. So they're already in a better place and maybe better prepared to take the next step toward being housing ready.
So Lot 42 has about 40 people there, about half in tents, half in cabins. Community spirit is good, and I see on Facebook enough money was raised to fix Nadine Green's car. So hooray! These sites seem to be functioning well, and now what we need are more of these sites. And, as Jeff said, property owners with unused buildings or available property, not-for-profits, and faith communities all to come forward. Further to Jeff's reflections on the current situation, especially his words on the importance of a good night's sleep and the peace of mind and stability that comes from sleeping well, I talked to a young woman on Friday who had been kicked out of Monica Place, which is a temporary support home that supports pregnant or parenting youth and their children. Monica Place is described as a place that maintains a trauma-informed approach to providing support. The woman was kicked out for bad behavior, but she maintains she had been given neither written or verbal warning. There is an emergency order in the province. The authorities are insisting people stay home, and still the support home felt there were no other options but to kick a young single mother and her 1-year-old child out onto the streets. I realize the support home has to take care of all of its occupants, which is a difficult job. But how is introducing chaos and destabilizing and evicting a young woman and her child from their home, albeit a temporary one, beneficial to their health, both mental and physical, or their future? It's not. Irregardless of what happened, kicking a single mother and her child out of a secure life and into a pandemic is counterintuitive to health and well-being. Here is her story.
My name's Emma. I'm 24 years old. I reached out to Monica Avery Place originally in January 2019. I was 7 months pregnant. I was in a really hard spot in my life when I found out I was pregnant. I was using drugs and living on the street and had warrants out for my arrest. So I turned myself into police. And while incarcerated, I was given resources to reach out upon my release, and one of those places was Monica Avery Place. So I reached out, and they told me for their Cambridge location, I had to be parenting for 3 months. So I reached out to a different place called Marillac, where they accommodate pregnant women and newborns, and it's more close accommodation. There's more supervision and support immediately available, which is why Monica Place has that mandate. They want to make sure you can be okay while independent living. So I went there, and I was there until my daughter was 7.5 months old. I originally did my intake with Monica Avery Place in September 2019, where I met with a wonderful lady, the support and intake coordinator. I did the intake process, and they called me on my birthday that same year and told me they had an apartment for me February 1st, that I would be able to live there for a year with my daughter as long as I participated in their program properly. It's stage 2 transitional housing, so it's a part of a step 2 program. To teach mothers how to parent and teach them and offer them support during an independent living transition. Monica Place in Waterloo offers a much more close-based support. There's staff in the office 24 hours a day, 7 days a week to offer you on-hand support. There's rooms, there's a community, there's a communal kitchen, everybody gathers, there's dinners, all of the girls living there participate in programs together, et cetera. The second stage housing is a 2-bedroom apartment, and there's somebody in the office to offer support and advice during business hours, but you are in your apartment independently living with your own kitchen, your own bathroom, your own 2 bedrooms, essentially getting yourself ready to get into a 2-bedroom apartment by yourself. And for somebody coming from somewhere like I was, this was a perfect opportunity for me because I obviously needed the help. That's why I didn't just try and have my baby and stay with a friend. No, I needed the help, obviously.
Yeah.
I needed the support, and this was a perfect opportunity to learn how to live with less support and my own space. I went from a little bedroom with my 7-month-old child to a 2-bedroom apartment. It was great. I was there for 6 months. I met all their program requirements. I never had any disciplinary action placed against me. I didn't have any verbal or written warnings. Me and all of the staff were on good terms, all of the staff that work in the building. And I'd never had any interaction with any staff outside of the building. And recently, a picture was taken of me in the designated smoking area outside of the building I live in, downtown Cambridge. It was at 9:45 in the morning. And a lot of slanderous allegations were attached to the picture that our children were sitting outside in 35-degree weather, et cetera, et cetera. It was posted publicly on Facebook, and I've never met the woman who posted it before. I also had no interaction with her during this entire process. I attempted to call the police, and they told me there was nothing they could do because the pictures weren't illicit or expressing any nudity. So I just kind of had to ride it out. I immediately took a screenshot of the post and reported it to the staff that work in the building. They told me not to worry too much, that I had done nothing wrong, and that hopefully it would all blow over. But unfortunately, a member of the community saw that Facebook post and called the executive director, who I've never met before. I had a phone call with her while I was in crisis to get permission to have my mom come over during the crisis, the COVID lockdown. I think, just to get, preemptive permission because I was in a bad mental health place. Because COVID took its toll on absolutely everybody in its own way. But one of those ways for me was I was isolated with no family allowed in the building with a toddler. It was very difficult, but thankfully I had good support in the building because the staff there that work on site are great. But as all of this was coming to an end and people were out and about more, I guess we were photographed, and that photograph was reported to the executive director, and she followed up the following Tuesday with me, the appointment at 9:30 in the morning. This is the first time I've ever met this woman, and my child was in the respite care provided by the staff there. Okay. So she wasn't present for this meeting, and she still never met my daughter. She asked me how I felt about the action in that photo and having it publicly displayed for everyone to see. Mm. And I said, I don't see anything wrong because I'm not doing anything wrong in the picture. Those are only allegations. And she told me I made the decision easy for her that I was being given 48 hours notice of eviction, and she was notifying Family and Children's Services. And she got up and left. I was handed no paperwork, nothing. I handed in my keys yesterday, and I'm on my way to retrieve the last of my belongings today. The staff on site have been extremely supportive through this process. I just want to make note of that. They are kind and wonderful, and they had absolutely no say in this process.
It's Monica Place in Cambridge, is it?
Yeah, they had absolutely no say in this process. I have a perfectly clean disciplinary record there. I've passed all of my unit inspections. They inspect our apartments monthly, obviously, for safety and cleanliness. I've passed all of my inspections. I've complied with all the restrictions that have been put in place during COVID as they've gotten worse and worse and more strict. During all of this, I also took my drug counseling. I had my schooling put on hold, and I was in a, like, extremely bad mental place, and I was just starting to come out of all of this. I was looking forward to my child getting referred to daycare, starting employment training program. I was really looking forward to, like, being able to do things with stable housing. I've struggled with housing for so many years, living on the streets, having a drug problem, etc. And it just really shakes me that they could do this to my daughter, honestly, above all else, because she's wonderful, and nothing's being honestly taken into consideration. Like, I have been living in supportive housing for almost 2 years now, including my pregnancy time, and with her, it's been about a year and a half. And during that time, there's been logs written about my behavior, my parenting, my mental, emotional health and stability, my efforts to find secure, stable housing, complete my education, etc. There's also cameras on the building, so they could very well see that we were outside at 9:30 in the morning for less than 20 minutes, and our children were definitely not at risk to heat stroke, which was the allegation attached to the picture that she expressed extreme concern about.
You were just outside having a cigarette, and they accused you of smoking meth? Is that correct?
There were comments on the picture of people accusing us of doing illicit drugs, talking about my drug past, because I've lived in Cambridge my entire life, so I was expecting eviction because I know when incidents happen of public humiliation on organizations like this, it needs to be taken very seriously because I know that they are publicly funded, and I understand that. And I did expect some kind of action to be taken against me because I understand the seriousness of what was going on, but I did not expect to be served with a 48-hour eviction notice and be told that Family and Children's Services was coming. Also, I want to add the fact, there was another girl posted in the picture with me. She was given the same conversation by the executive director. She cried, she bawled her eyes out. I'm partially institutionalized. I can't cry when faced with intimidated authority like that. I just kind of close off and I'm cold. And I gave her respectful, calm answers instead of allowing my emotions to get heightened, because that's what I've been taught to do over so many years. Mm-hmm. The other girl in the photograph, she was given a 2-week suspension off of property, but I was actually recently in touch with her this morning, and they called Family and Children's Services on her as well, and Family and Children's Services came to her and took her child this morning and told her she will also never see her other two older children who she was currently going through court battles with. She will never get them back again because of this. They suspended her from the building for 2 weeks. When you're in the HISA system that the shelter programs use here, mm-hmm. and you have an address and you have a bed and somewhere to stay, mm-hmm. which she does here at Monica Ainslie Place, she can't call another shelter and ask to stay there because she's been told to stay away for 2 weeks.
So what does she do?
Exactly. We are on low-income OW assistance, baby bonus, etc. And she also gets deductions from her government assistance like GST and Trillium because of the other two children she has, and paying back pay support for them. So she actually has less money coming in than even me, and I have the minimum amount with no garnish interference. So So what can she afford to do when they kick us out 2-3 days before OW assistance pays out? She pretty much had to pack her bags, what she could fit in the trunk, expecting to come back to her apartment in 2 weeks. Her and a 7-month-old baby. I'm staying safely with a friend right now. I'm on the wait list to get into another shelter because my eviction was immediate. I was able to make those phone calls the same day. And now I'm at the struggle of trying to find room for all this furniture, all of these things that who knows when I'll be able to pull them out of storage. Somebody that may have been in less of a position to budget, like COVID cut a lot of things off, so, and it also granted a lot of extra funding, and I saved all of that. In a different situation where that may have not been possible, or for somebody who has less available to do that, they may not have had the resources to just go and get a storage unit. I thankfully have my mom, who is a good family support, but my friend who was involved in this situation, she does not have any good family supports available for her. She was also trying to get into a program called KW Safe Families when all of this was going on, and they offer help with, like, having a safe place for your child to go in an instance of mental health crisis, or, you know, needing to, like, go to a day program, for example, get some counseling, you know, like, in a state of crisis. So you don't need to call Family and Children's Services and say, hey, can you bring my kid to foster care? You can call Safe Families and say, hey, I need to do a month of intensive counseling. Can you please set me up with somewhere safe for my child to go for the duration of this program? And they can help you with that. They are a wonderful program.
Right.
And she was in the process of trying to find this help. And like I said, I'm thankful I have family support. When I got that phone call, I was able to call my mom, and she was able to come take my daughter. And I was able to get my house packed in 2 days. And where I went with the safe place to stay, there are stable and capable and responsible adults. So my daughter's not with me right now. She's napping in a playpen at home with someone else, happily, while I go and finish packing up the rest of our house. I'm lucky to have these supports. Some of these girls don't. That makes me very sad that you can do everything right. You can do absolutely everything right. Because I was. And the executive director can just come down and decide that she doesn't like your answer to her question. Because ultimately, that's what it was. She came down there with a vendetta in her mind that I didn't even know about. And when she did not like the answer to my question, she decided that I was gone.
Right. And there was, and again, there was no warnings. There was no previous indications
of... I've handed in my keys. I've gotten my key deposit returned, and I've still been handed nothing in writing.
It sounds like they are saying that you were smoking drugs or you were doing some kind of illicit activity, but you weren't.
No.
No.
And there's nothing was photographed, especially. Like it's all allegations on a picture. During the time that I've had my child, I'm glad that I've built healthy and stable relationships. And that I've gotten my own mental health in check and gotten the counseling and help that has been available. There is help available. It just needs to be provided. And the hard part with this place is, like, reaching out for help, and it's not provided.
Did she give you a reason?
She told me to make my bad choices somewhere else. One of the staff members, once I was cleaning my apartment yesterday, came to me and told me that she thought this was wrong. It was sad. Because they have a chart in their office with, like, you know, tenants' names and everything, and all, like, the steps and anything that they've gotten against them for quick reference when making decisions on their computer and logging, et cetera. And she said, I'm blank. I've had nothing. The whole 6 months I've been there, I've had no warnings about anything.
Right.
I've been on my best behavior because I really didn't want to blow this for me and my daughter. And because of COVID also, I was looking at possibly having my lease extended past the year. Most of the time, they would offer a two-year lease in their program, but I was already at the maximum age for their mandate. I'm 24. So I was offered a one-year lease, but then COVID happened, school got canceled, and everything that I was supposed to have accomplished in their program was put on pause. And obviously, they couldn't hold that against us at the time. They weren't, like, we couldn't do anything.
Yeah.
But also, that means I was using up time on my lease without being able to do anything. So I was looking at having an extension. On my lease and granted more time because of COVID.
Absolutely.
And so I was on my absolute best behavior. I did not want to blow this. I was hoping to get 6 more months added onto my lease, and I got 6 months taken off of it over a photograph.
On this episode of CKMS News, we got an update from Jeff Wilmer on Lot 42, and we spoke to Emma about her recent eviction from Monica Place in Cambridge. You've been listening to the CKMS Newsroom. I'm Trish Holmes, and check out our archive versions of this program and other episodes on radiowaterloo.ca/news. You can follow us on Twitter at Radio Waterloo, and you can email news@radiowaterloo.ca to get in touch with comments or ideas about stories to cover. Thanks very much for your time.